Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey, Justin.
Hey, what's up?
So, you know how I always say, like, if you have a LinkedIn profile and then you have a gap in employment, what do I always say? You should do what?
Lie.
Yes and no.
Oh, wait. What was it?
No, you say you're a consultant. That's what you do. You just say you're a consultant during like that.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, because of course, if somebody asks you a question, you're going to, you know, you don't have to say that you're consulting for like something, you know, huge. If somebody asks you a question, you can say you're a consultant and you can make money as a consultant. Did you know that?
You could be at a dinner. Somebody could ask you a question and if you answer it, you're consulting.
You're consulting. Exactly. But the question is, have you ever thought about what it takes to learn how to be a consultant?
I would love to know.
Really? Because you make a pretty good one, I think. So let's see if that's true. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Marketing Geeks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right. So our guest is an expert in digital marketing strategy, and he serves as an advisor for SCORE Rhode Island. You know, we met at SCORE. We talk about SCORE a lot on the show. We met in SCORE Ventura, and he has consulted with funded startups and nine-figure organizations. And he has a keen awareness on a focus on what efforts are effective, relevant, and sustainable based on the company's unique market and situation. He's also written some books that I'm going to get into. I'll let him talk about that. But best of all, he has his own consulting training company. And this is something I really want to find out. Like, really, what does it take to be a consultant? Well, this guy's going to tell us all, ladies and gentlemen, David J. Bradley.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Yeah, man. Thank you for being on the show. How's quarantine treating you?
Ooh, it started rough. I'll be honest. It started rough for a couple of weeks there and just trying to get used to things.
Tell me all about that.
I miss my office. I miss the routine. I spent five years working from home, and then I got an office, and now I was struggling to get back into the routine of actually working every day, without being able to go there. But, things are starting to turn around. I'm used to the new routine, the new normal.
Do you need like a structure of like getting up and going somewhere to keep yourself kind of on task? If left to my own devices, like if I had no responsibility and I just won the lottery, they would find me in 5 years, just like Bin Laden, sitting in my house, watching pornography, you know, probably smoking way too much weed.
Which sounds like a great life, but we do have to work too.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No,
I'm working towards that.
I was pretty good at it for a while until I got the office. And then I completely lost my ability to be so productive at home. It was a weird turn for me because I always resisted getting an office because I figured I was so productive from my house. But yeah, I like the routine now. I like mixing it up. I like getting to the office. And I know when I get there, if I spend 4 hours there, it's just as productive as being home for 8 hours and working. I just have a much higher level of productivity.
Yeah. Do you have kids by any chance?
I don't. I have a dog that'll distract me at home, but no kids.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, but I totally understand it because I partly miss going to the office. I also do like being at home too. So I understand the double-edged sword, but I'd like to get a little, first of all, for our listeners who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit more about like who you are and what you do and what your main project is right now?
Sure. So I have been in marketing for what feels like forever now, but a solid 10 years or so as a consultant, as a freelancer, the past 6 years or so with my own consulting firm, or might be going on 7, losing track of time. That's part of quarantine too.
Yeah.
Over the last couple of years, I started to get more into the coaching of other marketing consultants, marketing agencies, and started working on that side. And, you know, that's a very crowded area, but, you know, I make it a pretty structured process to understand how coaching works, how to teach people. I teach at a college as well, marketing. So that has been where I've noticed my passion being on that teaching and coaching side and working with people to help them establish their own business. So that's where most of my attention has shifted as opposed to client services. And that's what a consulting MBA program is. That's where I focus most of my time at this point of trying to continually help new folks in starting their own marketing practice.
Now, do you have an MBA? What's with the name consulting MBA? Where did that come from? Is that your educational background? Is that what brought that up? Or what's the story behind that?
Yeah, a bit. So I did get my MBA back in 2015. And then I used that kind of as my hook in branding, just for myself personally for a while, because it was somewhat unique in marketing to have the MBA. But then I used it because the MBA terminology has a connotation of something being rigorous, right? So I published a book in 2019, Digital Marketing MBA. I have consulting MBA. It's all just supposed to relate to that kind of rigorous structure of having a formalized education around that topic, consulting, digital marketing, and so on. So that's the idea.
So were you doing consulting for a while and then you started because consulting MBA is a digital training for people who want to be consultants, right?
Right, right.
So how did that come about?
That really happened organically. You know, I spent the past 6-7 years doing consulting on my own with my firm, and probably 3-4 years before that, kind of freelance, just less formalized. And somewhere, say about 3 years ago, I just had a community of other marketers around me where we all kind of met as a mastermind kind of function. And that developed over time where I wasn't just facilitating the mastermind, but I was really giving them the steps forward to take, kind of guiding them along. As I was learning, I was able to kind of simplify things, share with them, and get it going that way. And that was really the beginning of it, very organic with some peers.
And what would you say, I mean, what makes a consultant? What are kind of the things that you need to know before you walk in and say, hey, I'm a consultant?
It's good to know that there's a million other people walking in the room and saying, hey, I'm a consultant too. And that always seems common in marketing as well. A lot of marketing agency folks out there, a lot of marketing consultants that are networking. So it comes down to, all right, if everyone else is in the pool, I need to stand out somehow. So what is it going to be that makes me unique? And you don't really have that right until you're super uncomfortable with it, typically, because you have to be so specific and so narrow that it really truly does stand out. And at the same time, you're almost skittish about, is this going to work? Or
find your niche.
Is my pool so small? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk about a lot about niching down on the show and how that's kind of essential to running a business. So, I mean, what were you doing before you were a consultant? Were you always kind of an entrepreneurial sort of person, or was there, did you have the slave job for a while?
Something in the middle, I guess. Not sure. So back in high school, I might have even been junior high, I started just kind of messing around with websites. This was like back in the Angel Fire days where everything was hideous, but I had fun kind of messing around. So that introduced me to it, built up some forums, some communities about graphic design. It was just a fun hobby until I got into an actual working age and I can start to work for companies kind of a freelance fashion. And in college, my first 2 years, I had, I think it was 24 different jobs and projects that I worked on. Some of them are part-time and a lot of them are temporary 3-month gigs and internships and stuff like that. And that just spiraled forward. I never ended up getting a traditional 9-to-5. I just kept doing freelance work, consulting work, and here I am now.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was just really, you were always kind of, you went from solopreneur and just grew that out to having your own agency and the consulting MBA business. So those are basically, because you're still consulting, right?
So I'm still consulting. I have my firm BBG, where I do the more in-depth digital strategy consulting and some limited training, speaking, stuff like that. I have an affiliate agency that I'm an advisor to, KSA. So I'm helping them develop their digital division, leading that, but they're handling all the day-to-day client management type of stuff. And then I have consulting MBA. That's where I put the main focus day-to-day at this point.
So what makes a successful consultant besides the hook? We talked about the hook a little bit, like, or coming up with your moniker, whatever you want to call that. What else makes up a successful consultant? What are some of the things you're teaching that are going to be beneficial to someone that wants to break into the consulting industry?
Sure. So it's really the pillars of a good business model, right? So it's the niche of who I'm targeting. What's my target market? It's the service offering itself, and then it's how you're packaging that up, which is how you're presenting it, how you're structuring the deals, the pricing element to it. And it's a combination of those that then allows you also to actually communicate it in the right way. So they're essentially building blocks, and I don't think that in consulting there's anything that is that profound. I don't believe in the magic of these special funnels where you just plug in your name and then all of a sudden you got 40 clients a month knocking on your door. I don't go down any of those paths, but I do go down the path of here's how we make a business intelligently. And here's how we do it quickly because we cut out all the nonsense and the noise.
So can you give us some examples of give us as an example of like a recent client and how you handled their particular situation?
On the consulting side,
yeah,
consulting client. So there's one that I've worked with for a couple of months, let's say. And she's a very sharp consultant. And her issue is that she just kind of feels lost in the cycle of, well, there's so many marketing consultants out there. Anytime someone really gives me that attention to say, you know, we might be interested in doing a project, she feels like she has to take it because it's a new client, it's money coming in, it's a new deal that could turn into something else. And otherwise, she's just kind of spinning her wheels and doesn't really have business coming in reliably. So with her, it was a structured way to sit back and say, not just what am I communicating out there, but where do I want to see this business long term? Do I want to be the solo consultant 10 years from now, or do I want an agency around me? And breaking down the business model from there so that she can really get a structure to, all right, if that's where I want to be in 5 years, 10 years, what do I need to be doing today? And that fundamentally changed from I'm a marketing consultant to these are the kind of packages offered for content marketing services and content strategy. And that kind of fundamental of the offering born out of the future vision was the catalyst for her. She can piece everything else together from there. And that's just her case. It's always different. People have different hangups, but that was a major thing for her to kind of unlock what has to happen next.
So for packaging and pricing, I'm kind of curious, what are like a lot of your clients charging as consultants? Are they coming in as hourly consultants a lot? Are they selling blocks of time, blocks of hours? Are they offering retainer-based contracts? Like what are some of the packages that you're seeing that are common, and like what kind of price ranges for people that are getting started versus like advanced consultants?
Sure. So there's, I'd say, two categories. And some people come in with hourly fees, and I always push them away from that quickly. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with the pros and cons of that, and it's usually heavier on the con side. So there's retainers or project-based work. The projects, a lot of the folks starting out are looking at a few thousand dollars for whatever it might be. And that might be a new website. It might be a strategy of some sort. But the goal would be that you're looking at a five-figure deal for projects. On the retainer side, that's where most of the business is. And there, you know, you're looking at, say, $1,000 to $2,000 typically starting out for some basic work. It could be $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, especially for the heavier project management based work, like content marketing. It's very intensive typically to do effectively. So that might be a bit more. But I try to also shift everyone into quarterly retainers. I did quarterly exclusively for the last 2 years or so. And it makes a pretty dramatic impact on a consulting business, especially when folks are worried about every month, is this client going to cancel on me? If you're locked in quarterly, it gives you a little bit more leeway, a little bit more peace of mind. And I think from a marketer perspective, it puts the client in the right viewpoint of, all right, I'm not just committing for the next 30 days. This is another 90-day commitment. So all around, it seems to work better. And that's the biggest thing in terms of pricing that I help people shift into.
And do clients pay that up front? Do they pay the quarterly up front for you?
Yeah, always up front.
And do you give them discounts if they do like a year deal or a multi-year deal?
Depending on the size, either a 5 or 10% discount if it is paid up front for 6 or 12 months. But typically, it's a quarterly deal. I don't do anything locking in for a year. I might write it out in that sense, but not where I'm discounting to say, you know, you're going to stick with me for a year, unless they pay me all up front.
I just want to touch on this very thing, because this to me is one of the best pieces of advice you could ever give anybody. I built hundreds of websites when I was starting out, and one of my biggest regrets is that I didn't offer like a monthly service fee and start hosting the sites myself. You know, it's not where my passion lies to do that type of work. I can do it, but I could have outsourced it. And it's really a whole kind of passive stream of income that has completely, I didn't take advantage of. So I listened to David Bradley on this one, folks. If you have a consulting business or a web business or doing marketing, definitely employ that business model.
Yeah. I think that is probably one of the key things in getting people to shift into quarterly, offering quarterly packages and making that their standard, is really a mindset shift. And it's a place of coming into a sales meeting in a more powerful position and a more confident position. So it has a dramatic impact across the board.
So how do you determine how much to charge per hour to figure out what your fee is going to be? Because what I mean, I have my own method for doing that, but how do you judge what you should be paid when you ask for a bid?
Sure. So I try to look at it first and foremost in terms of what value is being provided. And if we can find a situation where I can draw a path to the client getting a 10x return, then I can charge whatever that fee is and be confident of it. So the value providing, which comes into what are they investing? What are they getting out of that? What's the customer actually worth in doing some of that math? First and foremost, that's one way to go about it. It's always helpful to be mindful of what the going rate is. If you know what competitors are typically charging, it's not a good idea to try to be the cheap option, but to have an idea of where they are. It's a helpful bit of data to have in your arsenal. And, you know, you can look at hourly in terms of just making sure that you're safe, but I would never show hourly to the client. So I'll go through the calculation of, for this project, this is how many hours are going into it. This is what I should be earning for my hours that I put in. And then I put a multiple on that because everything else takes longer than you expect.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my safety net. I say, if I can charge at least that much, at least I know I'm safe. But I start with value first and foremost. That's just a extra safety net, like I said.
Yeah. And I tend to do the same thing where my personal going rate is 75 an hour. If it's a bigger business that has money, I'll go to 150. I have a friend's rate, which that all depends. But 75 is about what I go for when I'm, you know, figuring out, yeah, it's going to take 10 hours to do this thing, 15 hours to do this other thing. And then once I get that figure, I give myself like a 15 to 20% raise.
There you go.
And then that's generally how. Yeah. But it seems like intuitively you're doing that same sort of thing. So if somebody's wanting to, I mean, we have a lot of people now specifically who now are suddenly out of work maybe, and now's a good time to start your own consulting business. If somebody's making that transition, what advice would you give someone like that?
I think if it's something where you're in it for the long term, it's not just going to, you know, fill the resume during this down period, but you're looking at it long term, try to focus on an area that you're actually going to be, I don't want to say passionate about, but, you know, relatively intrigued by, whether that's the service that you're providing or the industry that you're working within. And I think that's one of the areas of finding your niche that isn't emphasized enough, because, you know, there's always those lists of the top niches to go after. These are the hot niches that you need to jump into. This weird, who's spending money right now. But ultimately, it's helpful to wake up every day and be excited about your clients' businesses. And if you can do that, or at least the service that you provide, if you can do that, it makes it a whole lot easier to find success when your day-to-day is a little bit more intriguing.
So what would you say to somebody who has a passion to play the ukulele and he has a wife who thinks that it's really obnoxious?
Wow. Well, it's always...
You know what? You don't have to answer that question. It's just that maybe that's too much information. But, it's really a fantastic subject, because how much do I charge is always a big question that people deal with. But also we're going into such an uncertain time now, right? And we've been talking a lot about how people can really start teaching themselves new skills. And one of the things I love about being an entrepreneur, once you have your business license, it changes the conversation with yourself about, oh, how do I get a job, to where are the opportunities to make money? And giving you a business license is a great way to focus on your energy on making money rather than how am I going to, you know, get a job to support myself. So have you noticed any issues with the downturn? I mean, how has this affected you?
Sure. So there's definitely been some pullback from clients. All businesses out there are struggling to some degree, unless they're in a sector that's been protected. But I had a couple of clients that I've worked with in events and travel, and those are two areas that are highly affected, of course. But, you know, I'm at a place where I'm at least diversified enough personally that I'm relatively safe. And it's just kind of about what can I do to help support them at this point and give them the information that they need to keep going. But sure, it was tough just in the sense that, you know, these clients, specifically one in the sailing space, another one in professional sports, they have spent their lives or the last couple of years for the sailing client really focused on building up this business, and all of a sudden this pandemic comes in and takes it away. Wow. And it was tough, you know. That's definitely a tough thing to deal with, even though I was in a relatively safe space. I feel like I'm not an owner of those businesses, but I'm a stakeholder in some sense.
Yeah, totally.
And I've
found this with a few of the clients that I'm working with also, is that part of what I try to bring is ideas on how to pivot and how to make that viable using digital tools. And yes, there has been a few clients where I'm just like, I'm stumped. I don't even know how you're going to get out of this. And I get that, because you really want to help somebody. But if you cannot find a way for someone to pivot in this situation, yeah, it kind of fucks me up a little bit.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. And we're trying. So the sailing client's a sailing school. So we're looking at how to transition some of the classroom teaching to the online space. But at the end of the day, you still need to get on a sailboat. So there's things like that. And
now what about like group coaching? Are you doing anything with group coaching versus one-on-one? And even like corporate type groups as well? Are you teaching that kind of stuff on how to your clients are landing those kind of gigs, or is it mostly focused on the one-on-one side?
So my clients is mostly focused on the client projects and retainers, like we talked about, of marketing packages of some sort, marketing services.
Yep.
Occasionally, people will be interested in more of the training, the speaking side, but that's mostly reserved for people who have some level of experience anyhow, because they need the kind of intellectual backing of how do I actually communicate these ideas, where people starting out are still trying to get their grounding. So
yeah, very, very true. But what about just like groups then? Well, I mean, you know, cause there's this whole other side of things. Like you could run a mastermind type community and go in that route. Is that just kind of outside of your niche from what you're teaching?
Yeah, it's not something I teach. I was involved in it on and off from the perspective of running one, but also being a member in a couple different groups. And there's definitely value there, but it's just not a core activity that I would teach.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think that the idea of selling your knowledge in this way is really amazing. So was it, when you set that up, the consultingnba.com, what did you have to do in order to put that whole digital curriculum together?
Well, it's essentially looking back at the last couple of years, and I tried to dissect each individual coaching client that I had and figure out like, all right, what did we actually talk about? Unfortunately, I had meeting notes saved, so I can actually go through those and say, all right, these are the things that came up. And I took that as one basis, along with looking at my own career and being able to tick off like, all right, that went well. That was wrong. That was wrong. That was wrong. There's another win for me. I'm trying to reverse engineer. How can I cut out all of the wasted time, the ideas that didn't work out, and just focus on the essential pieces? And then, yeah, it's building the curriculum at that point.
Is it a combination of like video and PDFs or, you know, how do you present it? And do you have it on like, how did you build it? Like what technology did you use to actually put it together?
Sure. So it's on a platform, Thinkific, simple, easy to use, intuitive platform. And it is a series of videos with supporting materials, PDFs. Cool. I'm working on at some point having it produced in a physical format so I can mail it out to people so they have a real hard copy workbook to work with as well. So I think, you know, making that connection to something tangible, physical, it helps me a lot. It will be helpful.
For sure. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. A lot of digital courses don't do that, but I love the idea of sending someone out something that they can write in. It does make that sort of mind body connection to the material. So that's a fantastic idea. And how long did it take you to put it together?
It depends. It was similar to writing a book where it would come up in my calendar that I need to work on it. And I had all these other things to do. So I was like, all right, tomorrow I'll do that. So it dragged on for a long time.
Yeah. How long is a long time? Like years or decades?
Probably years.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it took a couple of months of semi-focused work where I'm developing the curriculum. I'm recording it. I'm editing it. And I'm publishing it and I'm working on the next piece and then the supporting materials. So a couple of months with a couple of years tagged on it, maybe.
And what's the model with your membership program? Is that something that people pay a one and done fee? They get access and then you do coaching on the back end, or do they pay a monthly, like an MRR on the coaching program too? Or so how does that pricing work on that?
So it's all one price, one time of $1,500. Mm-hmm. I might be changing that at some point, and I'm playing around with how I want that to actually look like. But I want it to be something right now that's feasible enough for people given the situation. And there's two coaching calls a week, so you can always jump on and get some live feedback. There's a Facebook group, so if you ever want to chat there, you can do that. But you pay the one time and you have access for as long as I'm around.
For life. Okay, that's a pretty good program.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's a long time.
Yeah, so, yeah. Right?
Yeah. It should be a good deal.
So far, so good, man.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about the books. So I see you have two books, or at least two books. You have the Getting Digital Marketing Right, A Simplified Process for Business Growth, Goal Attainment, and Powerful Marketing. And then you have Digital Marketing MBA, which is the guiding principles for researching, planning, and managing a marketing strategy to transform your business. Tell me a little bit about the books. I mean, you just mentioned that you know it took a long time to kind of get it done. Where were you in the business when you finally made the decision to write a book? What, like, roughly speaking, how long was the entire from idea to final book process? How long did that take? And what did it do for the brand and business?
Sure. So the first one was Getting Digital Marketing Right, which is about digital marketing strategy in a very simplified way, good for small business. And that took, there was probably 3 months of, you know, moving the writing entry on my calendar over to the next day, where all I got done was a table of contents, basically. And then I had a chat with someone and I came up with the thought that, all right, I'm going to sit down for 20 minutes every morning and write. Doesn't matter how much I get done, but that's small enough that I can actually commit to that. Mm-hmm. If it was any more, if it was a half an hour, I would wake up and say, nah, not today. But 20 minutes was too hard for me to say no to. And I committed to it being absolute shit quality and still being okay. And those two things made it possible for me to get done. I think it took 8 weeks from there.
Wow, that's cool.
And of course, sometimes it was 20 minutes, but sometimes it was a 4 or 8 hour writing session. Just depends on the day.
But what did it do for the business? So once you got the book out there, did it open up new doorways? Were you able to get new speaking gigs or opportunities to kind of share your message and voice? Like, how did that impact you?
So I definitely didn't leverage it enough because I was somewhat hesitant to just toot my own horn and put it out there until I published the second book. And now I'm a little bit more confident to say I'm a marketing author. I needed the second one for proof. But it brought in my best clients consistently. If I look back at who my best clients were, 9 out of 10 originally read my book and then reached out to me and then we worked together. So it was tremendous for the business. I did use it a bit in terms of speaking gigs and stuff like that. I just wasn't consistent enough with it at that point, I don't think. But it's a wonderful tool and it doesn't get thrown away like a business card would.
You also did some work. You do some speaking arrangements with SCORE. And I'd love to know kind of your overall experience with that. Justin and I actually met at SCORE, and I was doing regular speaking gigs there when I was living in California. And for those of you who don't know, SCORE, what does it stand for again? The Society of...
Well, I don't think it actually, the original acronym was Service Corps of Retired Executives.
Yes.
And I think they kind of moved away from that because it's now open to a younger demographic of teachers also. But that's what it originally started as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great service. It's free and people make connections there. It's a really good organization. But tell me about your experience with it and how did you get involved with them?
Yeah, well, my CPA was a SCORE mentor forever. And so he recommended that I get involved at some point. And in particular, because they needed the support, like Justin's saying, they're trying to diversify who their mentors are. So it isn't just the traditional old white man, white hair, and that's it. So they're really diversifying who they have around. And they needed some marketing support. So I got involved as a mentor, subject matter expert, workshop presenter, kind of did the gamut of it. Today I spent I think 2.5 hours on calls this morning, because I'm on the marketing committee, and I'm a volunteer, so I don't know, we call it the local board, and I've been working with them for 2 years now or so, from pretty much every capacity.
And have you been able to get, you've probably gotten clients from doing your classes, yeah?
A bit, yeah. I've done some classes on consulting, I've done some on marketing, and we're involved in a series now with the agency as well. And the webinar series we're doing is taking off pretty great as well, because SCORE has a tremendous reach among small businesses. Yeah. So it's been a great organization.
I think at some point when you're working with that organization, though, because the community it attracts, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, are people that are in the very, like, even in pre-contemplation stage, they haven't even started their business yet, or they're very, very new in business. So they're probably below the level that they're going to be your client, at least in the short term. However, when you're doing consulting, you never know who shows up 5 years later that's all of a sudden developed the business, or you also never know who they know and you can get referrals from it. Because I do a lot of work like that, and I've noticed that I'm not necessarily getting direct clients from that work, but there are relationships that build, or the other instructors are the people that I end up getting as clients or something like that. Like, it's funny how doing volunteer work can open up strange doors sometimes. So I'm a big advocate for it. But yeah, what has your experience been? I mean, is that what you're seeing, like what I'm talking about here? Or
yeah, a lot of the clients are very small, maybe don't have a business yet, coming up with an idea. There's occasional clients that have some budget, but it's pretty rare. But you know, it's something that you need to keep contained to a degree, because as a volunteer, you can spend every day on the phone with people who have a business or want to grow a business. So I've kept it pretty limited. After the first year was pretty draining, because I had a lot going on with them. And there's only so much business return you're going to get, unless your market is really that early stage business builder.
Yep. I've had very, very similar experience. So, and I'm still, like I said, I'm also doing that kind of work, not for SCORE currently, but for a similar type of organization. And yeah, the first year, I think I did too much consulting, which was very, very training for like zero return. But again, you never know what doors it opens up. And I've met some cool people along the way. I did want to ask you, because in your, in the kind of bio form that you submitted to us for this interview, you have a topic here. It says that you could tell us the one activity that you wish everyone would implement in their business today. And I have to know what that is.
Sure. So that is coming out of my second book, Digital Marketing MBA. And based in digital marketing, it's really kind of the exact opposite of that. I want people to sit back, do what we're doing now, have some conversations with their actual customers, and talk with them through their process of how do they do research on this purchase decision? What other competitors did they look to? What were their criteria for making the decision to invest in the product or service? And just pulling back into that. So it's not any kind of fancy digital marketing trick, nothing with analytics or AI or anything like that. It's sit down and talk to someone. And if you can make it a practice of once a month having a focus session to talk to a customer, all the better. You got to keep your finger on the pulse.
Yeah. Well, we often say like the best source of your information will come directly from your customers. Your existing customers they're the ones that are already paying you. Like, why not like learn from them about to find more people like them, right?
Yeah.
Another thing that in the bio, you talk about marketing budgets, and that's something that I'd be curious to have a conversation about. So when we're talking about marketing budgets, is as a consultant, you'll be guiding some of your clients, I'm sure, on different types of campaigns, like what they're willing to spend on social media marketing, what they're willing to spend on Facebook advertising or Google ads, things of that nature. I mean, mostly digital marketing, I'm assuming, because that's kind of the focus of our show and what we talk about the most. But like, how do you go about that? What's your process look like for setting budgets that are appropriate for a client? And I mean, are you looking at like what their, you know, their cash flow and all that? I mean, I'm just kind of curious what your process looks like.
So I try to help clients actually have a budgeting process typically, because a lot of the time they inherited a budget of some sort and they don't have an exact reason of why that number is what it is. It's just, we've been spending this much on this kind of marketing and this advertising, and that's, it adds up to this. I try to provide them with a formula and define that formula within the business that they're in. And it might change by industry and all of that caveats, but say you want someone to have a 5 to 10% range of their total revenues for the year invested in marketing. If it's a B2B business, it might be 5, 6, 7%. B2C, business consumer, 8, 9, 10%. That might depend on if they're more aggressive going higher or more conservative going lower. But if we can settle on a number, at least we have a starting point. And that number might be just straight media cost, or it might include the marketing team salaries and overhead and all of that. Again, that depends on the business. But eventually you settle on something that works for how they account for, you know, their own fees, the expenses that go into the business. And what we've done there is we've developed a formula, a very basic kind of algorithm, where we can say that's how we decided the marketing budget. And now it's not emotional. It's not a decision of, well, I feel like we should do this or that. It is more of a hard-pressed number. And you can shift that around and change it over time, but you're taking the emotional element out of the decision and just focusing on data. And that always seems to work a little bit better in that kind of decision.
And what about are you looking at ROIs too? I mean, if you're getting, you know, $1 in, $2 out, does that change things? I mean, are you willing to scale with budgets and make adjustments based on when you're seeing big ROIs, or are you kind of just sticking to the preset budgets?
Yeah, certainly. If it's possible to grow, I'm always all for it. It might change based on the client and their approach, but if we can map out that ROI and achieve it and see that there's more to be reached, usually try to reach forward for that. The tougher option is when you're not seeing the ROI and you need to pull back, doing that in a way that isn't going to handicap the business is the big challenge. Hmm.
How do you see advertising changing in the future? I mean, I'm curious because there's a firm belief I have that there's going to be something that's going to be introduced that will be the Facebook killer. And I can't see Facebook lasting forever, especially with their particular business practices. What do you see the future of marketing looking like? Do you have any predictions around that?
Sure. So I think I agree with you that Facebook as we know it isn't going to be Facebook, and it's already changing a bit in the market, but it seems like they're probably going to buy up as much of the competition as they can too.
Yeah, as much as they're allowed to.
As much as they can get away with. And who knows where that ends. But, I think it's one of those things where it always lags behind consumer behaviors. So you have to look to, well, where are the markets going? How are they changing how they behave? And there's certain things that happen, like this whole coronavirus situation, that acts as a catalyst that makes everyone much more comfortable on the digital side. Mm-hmm. And we're slowly getting more comfortable behind the camera, essentially, on Zoom calls, on social media and so on. So there's definitely much more of a visual component, I think. And I think at the same time, you can't get away with some of the older inauthentic marketing that's out there. I think creative is making more of a comeback, because for a while with digital, it was really all about data and letting that lead the way. And creative kind of, you know, had a shame on it, where it was just a lot of money for these cute ideas that didn't really do anything for business. And now you're seeing the marketing world say, all right, we need some creative that's really going to capture attention, and, you know, married with data still, of course. But I think the creative side of agencies is going to grow significantly in the years ahead.
Yeah. We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, and his whole agency was basically, he would make these really entertaining 4-minute kind of infomercials, and they had this very wacky vibe to it. And then he would do all the marketing around it too. And those two things together was like, that was pretty smart. Talk about niching down. So I agree with you that I think that it's definitely going to take more creative. And also, I think that people, like the whole like polished look of things is actually a distraction now, especially now that we've seen the inside of our colleagues' offices in their house, right? And yeah. do you remember like, what was it, even last year or 2 years ago, where there was that big viral video where the guy is from BBC and he's doing some sort of report. And then the one kid comes in, kind of stumbling in, and then the other kid comes in, and then his wife kind of comes in and scoops the kids out. And it was hysterical because it was so like, it felt so real, right? And now at the time it was a big deal, but now we've seen everybody's houses and what their environments are like. I think that we're due to have a more relaxed atmosphere around business and just around each other, hopefully. You know, we'll see. The country could use some relaxing.
Yeah, I could see that.
On the topic of advertising, where are you driving traffic for your clients a lot? Do you prefer Google? Do you prefer Facebook? Do you use any other outside sources that are not those two?
Those two plus LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn has gained a lot of steam over the last year and 2 years.
Paid or organic? Paid or organic?
Both.
Both.
Okay. Both. A lot of my work is on the paid side, but both areas are working pretty well.
Has LinkedIn made many advancements? I haven't run paid ads on LinkedIn for about 2 years. It's been a while since I had really played with that back end, and it was pretty low grade 2 years ago. I don't know. I'm kind of curious what's in play right now. I know that the cost per click was higher than on Google. However, if you have the right audience, it doesn't really matter what the cost per click is. It matters what the ROI is. So tell me a little bit about your experience running ads and what are you seeing success with LinkedIn? Are you running like image-based ads, video ads? What are you finding the most success with?
So LinkedIn is one of those things I have a love and hate with because there's so much opportunity there. Mm-hmm. But I still get multiple automated messages a day that make me super annoyed with the platform.
The messaging platform is ridiculous. I have 15,000 connections on there and I'm getting at least 20 a day. And I want to kind of read through so I can find the ones that are actually real. But so yeah. if you don't like say something that it makes it clear that this is not a robot message in the first like sentence, then I just ignore it. So yeah.
Oh, my name on LinkedIn is David J. Bradley for a reason. The J helps me figure out all the automated ones because they all say, "Hey, David J."
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, okay. That's brilliant.
Ignore.
I'm stealing that, man. I'm going to so steal that. So so anybody out there who either wants to become a consultant, like what would you, especially skills that people need to know right now? What do you think the most important skills someone needs to know in order to be successful in like a consulting field?
Well, the true honest answer is probably sales. It really comes down to, can I sell? I would just hope that you also have the talents to back up whatever services you're providing as well. But yeah, I mean, a good consultant is someone who's good at business development.
I still want to hear the LinkedIn ad stuff too, though.
Oh yeah. Do you want to circle back to that?
Yeah. Let's definitely.
I did want to hear your response on what you're doing with LinkedIn paid advertising.
Okay. So with LinkedIn advertising, to answer one part of the question, it hasn't progressed as much as you would hope. It's still kind of a clunky platform. It's not quite as smooth as Facebook's Business Manager and Ads Manager, even though that's not always ideal. So from a use standpoint, it's not great, but for the actual results, you might pay a little bit more than you might see on other platforms from a cost per click basis, but the amount of targeting options you have is something that really makes it worthwhile.
And you're also getting access. I mean, I just think like CEOs and executives and a lot of business people spend more time there than they do on Facebook. I mean, at least from a general standpoint, I'm sure some of them are on Facebook occasionally, but they're also not on Facebook for that reason. Where when you're on LinkedIn, you're on for that reason too.
Yeah, I think it's more thoughtful time as opposed to mindlessly kind of scrolling like we all will do on something like Facebook or Instagram. LinkedIn is a little bit more purposeful. So it seems to perform pretty well. Most of it that I do is right in the newsfeed. Ad pops up, drop an image in. Video can work well.
And are these just lead gen funnels? So they just go to a landing page, get the email, and kind of, and then drive them to a call or something? Or what's the CTA?
So one I started up recently with a client is leading into a webinar. They're doing like a biweekly lunch and learn style, but it's all virtual now. So it's a way to introduce a new relationship that isn't so sales focused, like, hey, schedule a call with us now. Easy way in, sharing value, educating them, and it's building leads up over time. So that's one kind of fun project we're doing right now, and that's all focused on LinkedIn.
Very cool.
Nice. Yeah. And it sounds like you had the same sort of thing. I found that LinkedIn ads, I've been running some large campaigns with them, and I find that they're definitely more expensive, but the KPIs are way better.
Yeah, definitely. I think LinkedIn just has that right factor right now, the right combination where, it's going to be a little expensive, but it should be worth it if you build a good quality campaign.
Have you done any campaigns on, say, TikTok or any other kind of
Snapchat? Snapchat.
Have you ever run campaigns off of those platforms?
I never really had a purpose to, so I haven't explored it yet. I'm curious to play around with them to some degree, but I worked with one company that did a little bit on Snapchat, but it wasn't to a great degree that I can share too much insight on.
You're not going for the 12-year-old million-dollar YouTube business owners?
No. As your clients? I'm too jealous, dude, to even bother.
I'm curious to run a Spotify ad campaign. I don't know if those would be... Have you ever done anything like that or know anybody who's done that?
I am in the process of... Well, I was in the process of staging one. And then coronavirus hit and events stopped, but it was for an event-based company. It seems pretty interesting if you're making the transition from radio to Spotify ads, if radio is already proven well for you, I think it makes sense to give it a shot. Fairly simple, intuitive type of platform, but it's just a measurement kind of thing at that point.
Yeah, super, man. Well, really great to kind of get a little bit of your knowledge. And I was wondering if somebody wanted to find out more about you, what would be the best way to do it?
You can go right to davidjbradley.com. That has all the links to my social, my other websites, consultingmba.com, thebbg.com, as my books up there, but that would be the best place, davidjbradley.com.
Nice. Well, finally, David J. Bradley, what do you find to be, what are you geeky about right now, man? What's your obsession?
So I just got into biking a bit. I was into trail running for a while, and now I want to be into mountain biking. And I haven't found a trail close enough to me where I can just get there without having to do some traveling. But that's going to be my new thing, I think. I need something that's exciting enough to stay active. Can't bring myself just to go to the gym every day, and gyms are closed. So mountain biking is my thing I'm geeking out on now.
You're in Rhode Island, right? So how closed is Rhode Island? Are they full shelter in place or where?
We supposedly opened last Saturday partially, but it's a very slow open. I think right now retail stores have a limit where they can only have 20% of capacity or something like that. Restaurants are closed except for takeout, et cetera. So things are pretty much offline for now.
What about on the entertainment side for your geekiness? Are you watching Netflix? Are you watching documentaries? Are you watching YouTube channels? Like what are you doing? What are you finding interesting, or what's a hobby you might have picked up outside of biking in the entertainment side?
I'll just stretch my intellectual muscles. Yeah. Rick and Morty season 4.
Yeah! Did you see the new episode? the brand new one that just got released?
I just found out about it because apparently I'm living under a rock. So I just got episode 1. I'm going to dig through it tonight.
It's this year's interdimensional cable / Morty's Mind Blowers. But the way they do it is really...
It's got a bit off the rails, but it's funny.
Yeah. In fact, I recommend that you look up Justin Roiland's his plot circle, the way he does that. There's a few videos on YouTube, and watch that first, like how he plots out a show, because it's very self-referential to that, which makes this episode like so much more funny. But this new episode was great.
I've seen all of them, but the new one. I still haven't seen the new one, Andres, but I just heard about it too. It's on my, like, it's on my queue.
So glad it's back.
Got to get to it.
I have just got into the show on Netflix called Ozark, and it is.
I watched like 6 episodes of it. It's pretty good.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. Yeah. My wife and I are binge watching it right now, and I am, you know, we just finished watching season 3 of Westworld, and it, you know, season 2 kind of dragged a little bit, and season 3, you know, it's pretty good, but Ozark is so well plotted and so well written that nothing drags in that show. And that's a rare thing when you can have that. So Ozark is what I'm geeking out about right now.
Yeah. Well, for me, I finished Better Call Saul season 5, which is my favorite show on TV right now. I mean, I'm looking forward to Dark season 3 when that finally rolls around. I don't know if you've seen Dark. That's this show on Netflix. It's kind of about time travel. I'll just say that. It's amazing. Like, it's the most well-written show I think I've ever seen in my life.
It's got this David Lynch sort of vibe to it.
Yeah, it does. It's just an incredible show. It's not even in English. It's in German, which is rare that I would be that into a show that's not even in my native language. We started watching Dead to Me season 2, that's okay. That's all.
Is it okay?
I saw that. It's okay. I'm like, I'm trying to think what we were just watching. I'm like, yeah, it's just okay.
Definitely get back into Ozark, man. It's super well done. Super duper. So, all right, David Bradley, thank you so much for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it. It was
great. Thank you.
And good luck with everything, man. And I want to check out your consulting MBA and see like how you did that. That's amazing. So really cool.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. All right. That was fantastic. So, yeah, man, what do you got for me?
What do I have for you? Well, that was, it was great to have David on the show here. Lots of cool information. Like I think it's always fascinating to learn about pricing, packaging, and even as a consultant working with clients, like helping them establish budgets. And as you know, for your own business, you're establishing budgets as well. So, I mean, those are all topics that are things that I'm, you know, always trying to get better at in my own business. So it's useful from a selfish standpoint. It's useful for me to learn this kind of stuff. So I always like, asking questions on that end.
Yeah, man. It's very interesting. I mean, you know, it brings up an interesting point because he said something, and this is something we also hear over and over again. The best skill that you can have as an entrepreneur is being a salesperson. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it, you know, hands down. And if that's an issue, then you need to partner with somebody who can do it, because you either got that or you don't. And if you don't try and make it happen. If you're just not a good salesperson, don't force it. It's horrible for everybody. Well,
I think there's different styles of sales. So I think that I do think that people with different personalities can sell, but you don't try and use the most well-known sales strategies, like the Tom Hopkins, like the Zig Ziglar, like the hardcore aggressive sales, like the stuff that the things that the archetypes of salespeople, you're never going to be that. If you have a personality that's dry, or you have a personality that's not outgoing, if you're an introverted person that doesn't like, it doesn't have a high social IQ, let's say, you're never going to succeed with that strategy. You have to adapt and you have to work with different areas of sales.
You know, what's really funny about that is, especially here in Europe, every country has their own little quirk about what they, you know, what's acceptable and what's not. In the UK, they sell a lot like Americans do, but it's even a little more hardcore. So here's the difference between the Dutch.
But I love their accents are way better than ours in America.
Yeah, they're way better than the Dutches also, I hate to say. The Brits, definitely, you guys got the accents.
The Aussies and the Brits, they got us all beat.
New Zealand's pretty good too.
Yeah.
Anyway, the wild thing is that there was a company that wanted to work with the company I'm working with. And they talked to the marketing director and he said, yeah, I was going to work for them. But it was this guy out of the UK and he told me that I'm the last one, like he's saving a spot for me. And that if I don't sign up right now, then he may not be able to make it happen. And the guy was just like, I don't know. No, that's not going to, no, forget it. I'm not going to work with you at all. And because the Dutch are very, they're very skeptical people and they tell it like it is.
What if that was true? Maybe it was true. Probably not. It's probably just a false scarcity move, which is the most common thing in sales and marketing ever. But you never know. It might have been true.
Yeah. And I don't think that type of hard scarcity selling is going to work anymore. It's people see through it and it rubs them the wrong way.
Well, to an extent, there's two things there. I mean, the way that it's been done in the past won't work anymore, but it's just still our brains are still also hardwired to certain emotional triggers and things like that. So those triggers are always going to be there. They're just going to be, people are going to get creative and find different ways of doing it. But I think you're right though. But I don't think you're not going to see like there's just one left. I mean, you might see other ways of triggering that same scarcity mindset, but in a different method.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could always use what my, like I could sell like my grandma used to talk to me. If I did that, then I would say something like, okay, so you don't want to get really a lot of clients with this type of thing. That's fine. See if I care. I'm just going to sit over here by myself. And
I mean, there is something called real scarcity. So like if you're true and you say like, I'm only offering this for 24 hours and then you stop and you actually honor that 24 hour window, right. That's real scarcity. And that can be effective. And I think what we're probably moving towards is where the people that are lying about like fake timers and fake things like that, which is very, very common. That is the stuff that's going to get the backlash. But if you're legitimately saying this is only available 24 hours, then the price goes up. And then after 24 hours, the price actually goes up and that's actually what's being sold.
Or AppSumo, which is both of our kryptonite is, they do that very well because they'll put things on there that are amazing. And if you don't buy it by the time it's out, you don't get it ever.
Except now they have that like one day only, it's available again for 24 hours thing, which I don't like that actually.
Really? Well, I don't know. It's sometimes.
Then I feel like, that cheapens. Like, I feel like, oh, I got a great deal. And then it's like, oh, other people are getting in on this guy. Lame.
I know, but I've got some good stuff with them.
I've gotten some amazing stuff. And then I've also spent a lot of money on stuff I haven't opened in a long time.
You got to go through that, man. We got to give some reviews on it.
I know. I need to, like, seriously, I need to just go through, like, all this old software that I got. Like, I can't even remember all of it.
I know you and I, we share that, man. We're software hoarders.
Yep. Software. I'm a software hoarder. I'm an e-book hoarder, ebook hoarder, learning hoarder.
Yeah, man. I guess we share that. And hopefully all of our listeners do too, so they can listen to hoard all of these episodes. Listen to them. Let us know what you think. And it's your birthday today.
Episode. It is my birthday.
It's so happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. You know what? Just listening to myself right now, I'm starting to understand why Iris doesn't like my
ukulele. Like if you just got rid of the words, it's fine.
Well, if you want to hear some damn good ukulele, I'll take us out. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to Marketing Geeks.
Out. Stay classy.
Marketing Geeks, come on, bring your friends. We'll learn marketing from distant lands. Andrew Sturgeon and Justin Womack, the fun will never end. It's Marketing Geeks.
Marketing Geeks.